dancing in the apocalypse.
I gotta get up at 5 o'clock in the morning and sparkle, Neely, sparkle.
I know what some of your big city no bra wearing hairy legged women livers might say.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to another episode of Maximum Film. It is episode 227, and I'm your host, Ify Whiteyway, and in the booth with me are my friends. So let me introduce you to them. First up, we have the Christmas Zaddy himself, esteemed critic and author alike, Alonzo Duralde. What's good?
Well, what's good is that we're at episode 227. I am not going to do a Jack Hay impersonation for the run of the show. As tempting as that might have been, I just, I don't know that I could really maintain that level of awesomeness. What's good for me is the Showtime series Yellow Jackets, which I'm a little late in getting to and still catching up. So don't tell me anything. I'm not there yet. I'm about three or four in. But oh man, this show is just like, it's funny and it's violent and it's terrifying and there's a mystery and there's a couple of mysteries actually, and it's as somebody said, it feels like peak Gen X visibility. You know, it's about these this high school girls soccer team who on their way to nationals in 1996, their plane crashes in the Canadian wilderness. They did something to survive. We're still learning what exactly, but then we also cut to them in the present day where things are very complicated and they're still trying to like quash secrets from the past. It's got a big plum role for the wonderful, wonderful Melanie Lynskey, which is always a good thing. But I mean, Juliette Lewis and Christina Ricci and just like an amazing ensemble. And it's just dark and weird and funny. And I cannot wait to see where this thing goes. So that is my post-holiday thing to be watching every night now that I burned through season 10 of Letterkenny in record time.
Ooh. Nice, nice. I like that. Those are some good things to watch. But we have someone here who knows all about good things to watch, because if you want to ever see, I'm not even going to tease you with this. Well, I'm going to finish it because I started. But if you ever want to see your film in a festival, you got to go through this person.
No.
That is the queen of the Midwest herself, festival programmer and producer extraordinaire, Drea Clark. What's good?
Oh, my God. That's not how festival programming works.
It's just one person, right? One person watches all the films.
Yes, just one person at every single festival.
You have to answer her three questions or you will not cross the bridge.
Yeah. Also, I'm very excited to start Yellow Jackets, which I'm going to do this week, because as you know, I wait until
right
now
it's bingeable. Right.
And so this is my time. I can't wait. It's all I'm going to see for the next few days, and I'm going to get real obnoxious with it. My what's good, however, could not be further away. And guys, it's bagged salads. And that's not a euphemism. I actually mean bagged salads, because in the last week or two, I've discovered my grocery store has all of these. I hear myself, by the way, and it sounds like a cry for help, but I promise you, I genuinely enjoy it.
It's the little things, Drea.
It is. There's all these fun new flavors. There is a dill pickle bagged salad flavor. There is an everything but the bagel. I hear it. I hear it, but I enjoy it. I'm really proud of that. What's good. And I don't think any of you should worry about me at all, but I certainly have been enjoying some exotic flavors of bag salads recently.
That is a pandemic year three. What's good if ever I heard one.
I'm proud of you for being proud of that.
Thank you.
You know, you're just reaching new heights with salads.
She may not be going to Park City this year, but dang it. There's a dill pickle salad waiting at home in the fridge.
It's just as cultural here. Yeah.
Oh, wow. Well, as in the booth with us, we often have amazing guests, illustrious guests, regular guests, past guests, future guests. Past hosts. What did I say? Yes, it's none other than the hilarious, the illustrious, the amazing comedian Ricky Carmona, baby. Oh. What's good?
Oh, friends.
Ricky.
Hey, y'all. How we doing, friends? Look at you beautiful people. I can see you, but now everybody out there can hear you as well. Oh, this is great. Thank you for having me. It's good to be back. What is good? First of all, I'm going to jump off of what Alonzo said there. Yellow Jackets is the truth, yo. I'm very excited for you to see what else happens, Alonzo. What else is good with me? I'm going to keep
talking. That's weird. It sounds like you're not going to also bounce off what I said.
I'm not going to bounce off of what you said, Drana. But I will give a shout out to Everything But the Bagel Seasoning. Because that fucks with that on the regular.
Banger.
That fucks with that on the regular. But in a way, I'm glad you said that, Drea, because I am going to bounce off of all three of you. I'm kind of cheating here. Another what's good for me was your episode of Matrix Resurrections, because I fucking love that movie, and I haven't had really a chance to talk to a lot of people about it. But you all know how I feel about Cloud Atlas, and we're not going to go there right now. But y'all know how close that movie is to my heart. And once again, Lana, bless her soul, just showing us the power of love, y'all. Cue the Huey Lewis. Come on.
Right?
Come on.
Cue the Huey Lewis.
Come on.
Yes. The only thing that could have improved Matrix Resurrections is Mr. Lewis in the news. That's it.
But my for real, what's good is I just listened to Martin Short's autobiography. I must say, my life as a humble comedy legend.
I'm getting it. I'm putting it on the list right now.
He reads it himself. It's like listening to your favorite person, your favorite uncle, your favorite friend. Martin Short's an elder statesman now. You know, if you want to call him a grandfather, he's just that. I've grown up watching Martin Short movies, and his book is just it's great. It's amazing. Like, he's like a positive ass dude, and he tells like great stories about like coming up in the business. And I didn't know like his wife has like passed away, and he talks just like so lovingly about his wife and his family. It's like it just makes you feel good listening to his stories. So I highly recommend Martin Short's autobiography.
I love Martin Short, national treasure of two countries.
Yes.
Yes.
I just put it in Libby, so very excited.
Oh, nice.
I love an audiobook, you know, especially from a comedy person. Like they,
read
you know,
by themselves. Yeah.
Like, who else are they going to hand it off to, for heaven's sake?
Right? Martin Short, read by Stephen King. Like, you just have to take a hard turn. Huh, into
Amy Tan was not expecting that, but okay.
Oh my God, Iffy, what's good with you?
Oh, what is good with me? Well, there's only one thing I could say this week, and you already know what I'm gonna say. If you're following me on Twitter, you know that you know, James Gunn decided to go on and make a whole spin-off TV series about Peacemaker from the Suicide Squad films. And I'm going to be hosting the after show podcast with my friend Fiona Nova. It's fun. I can tell you it's fun because we pre-taped it all. It's done. We're like, people were suggesting people we should speak to. I'm like, oh, we done. We did it. So we've finished taping it, and I have seen the whole season, and I gotta say, it's worth checking out the show. And you know, if you like the way I talk about stuff on here, it's pretty much the same here. Like the Harder They Fall episode, the same way I was both complimenting the art form and shilling for a job. That's that. I took that right to HBO Max, baby. I took it right to HBO Max, baby. So if you see me in Suicide Squad 2, you know what it do. You can get that wherever you get your podcasts, or you know, it's also going to be on HBO Max itself. It's a video pod thing. So, you know, when you saw Issa Rae and Pintus Prinny sipping on some wine, it's like that, except it's me. So real excited. I'm so excited I can just finally talk about it, because that's the thing about doing things in this industry, is you do cool shit and then you have to shut up about it. And you hear people
and
talk.
You are not. No, the best
no, you know. I don't. Yeah, no. It's so hard to shut up for me. It's the hardest thing I can do. It's like I feel bad when I go on other podcasts because I'm like, you know, my co-hosts on Maximum Film know to cut me off. But if you don't know that, then I'm talking over you the whole time. But I need you to jump in. This is double Dutch, okay? This isn't the line at the cafeteria. We out here spinning around, back flipping, jumping out, jumping in. You know the deal. And if you don't, look it up. Double
so all your time in the gym wasn't just for thirst traps. You're just dressing for the job you want.
Yeah, exactly. I need to be a
get
superhero.
Get this man a superhero costume stat.
So make me some obscure, like 60s hero that dies in the first 5 minutes. Like, let's do that.
If 60s comic books are known for anything, it's for all those black superheroes.
I know I have three more options and then we're out.
Act fast.
Yes. All right. All right. Coming up on the show today, we're going to talk about a sensitive topic that the Madrigal family would like us to ignore.
We don't talk about Bruno. No, no, no. We don't talk about Bruno.
Lo siento, familia Madrigal. On this show, we do talk about Bruno, as well as the other characters from Disney's Encanto. I wish I did not hit lo siento as anglicized as a lo siento.
No, that was awesome.
Yeah, that was.
It's all real, working.
You know. The guacamole in my apartment just got rotten when you said it that way.
Yeah.
Straight brown.
All his tortillas shriveled up.
Oh, man. Well, and what better way to honor such an amazing, diverse Disney movie by looking back at Disney's more questionable films of the past? And of course, we're going to have the staff picks. But first, it's time for IDIC, short for Is This Important? Do I Care? It is the news segment where we go through and read headlines and decide between all of us, is it important and do we care? First up, we're going to have El Papi Navideño kicking it off.
So this is somebody reading my diary. Penelope Cruz wants to do a musical with her husband, with Pedro Almodovar directing. Last week, the Palm Springs International Film Festival awarded actress Penelope Cruz the International Star Award for her performance in Parallel Mothers, directed by Pedro Almodovar. Entertainment Tonight spoke with Cruz about her partnership with Almodovar and what she'd like to do with him next. Here's what she had to say.
Journalists are asking me, what would you like to do with Pedro? Something you haven't done together. And it's true that the first thing that comes to mind is a musical. We have to do a musical together. And everyone has such an enthusiastic reaction when I say that. Mm-hmm. Everyone, every fan of Pedro Almodovar wants to see his musical.
Es importante? Te importa?
I love it.
Any and all Penelope Cruz news is importante.
First off, I feel like it's important to know we started the show with Iffy showing us that he's up to 500 words in Spanish on Duolingo. They're coming through.
Yeah, we're getting them all this episode.
Started it early, hitting all those words.
Oh, yeah. I'm ready to get at it. I've changed my phone to only speak to me in Spanish. No. Can't wait till that backfires. But until then.
Yes, definitely. I do love this story, though, because, I mean, obviously, this seems like a pretty clear Almodovar and Penelope Cruz loving space. And I really love a good artistic partnership like that, especially because I think that they don't have a rut. I think that he gives her characters that feel unique and like there's a progression to what they're doing. And also, Pedro is someone who seems so poised to make such an incredible musical. Like, I don't care if, I mean, to me, Penelope Cruz saying it means it's well above the sort of pipe dream category.
Yeah.
But, and you know, like obviously Javier Bardem, world famous Cuban, just played Ricky Ricardo and like had some like singing
SAG
elements.
SAG Award nominee.
Yeah.
Oh my God. That's a whole other. But I would love to see the two of them together. I would love to see them in a musical. And I would hands down love to see an Almodovar musical. I mean,
oh, no question. Yeah, I mean, he's,
eyeballs, he's such colors,
a, he's exactly such a visual stylist already. We've gotten a few hints at it. I believe there's like a there's a dance number that breaks out in like Kika, I think, in a prison yard or something. I'm forgetting which one of those 90s movies. I mean, what I worry about is that I've been seeing all these articles about, because West Side Story didn't do well, you know, because they released it during a pandemic spike, and because In the Heights didn't do well because it also played on HBO Max, suddenly there's this new thing like, oh, musicals, nobody wants to see them, they're not going to make money. And I mean, I hope that for whatever, you know, Spanish and European sources of funding that Almodovar generally turns to for this kind of thing, that's not an issue, and they're not going to like hold the performance of those movies against the idea of him doing a musical, because yes, I want it, and I want it now.
I'm very much looking forward to this Almodovar musical. I'm looking more forward to it than I was to, Alonzo mentioned Spielberg and West Side Story. My issue still with musicals, and will always be with musicals, is if you just give me like the same old thing, which, you know, outside of musicals, that's just kind of what movies are right now with IP and franchises and whatnot. But like, I just don't need to see West Side Story again. Like, and I'm grateful that now you've put us in it, but like, give me, I saw In the Heights, and guess what? I fucking loved In the Heights, because it's not,
I love that.
Cause it's not the same old, and then I went to the bathroom. Like, I just don't
Ricky,
need
if
that
you're,
shit.
If you're looking for not the same old musical, I have a little film called Annette that I would now, pay money to watch you watch.
Here's the other side of that. Is I started watching Annette like 2 months ago, and I'm still not done with it. And I am trying really hard, because that is what I want. Hey, fucking change it up. Let's go. Now they're giving me that, but it's, you know, I haven't finished it yet, so it might come around and wheel me back in, but right now I'm just,
and the monkey's paw curls another thing.
Iffy,
yeah,
take us to two.
All right, thank you for the handoff, Drea. But I gotta say, I know what's been on our minds. I know what we've been afraid of. Some of us haven't been able to sleep because we've been wondering, will the Oscars have a host this year? Well, look, if you're a fan of wild speculation, I've got some great news for you. The Oscars will have an actual host this year, but we don't know who it's going to be. Craig Erwich, the president of Hulu Originals and ABC Entertainment, made the announcement earlier this week during ABC's Television Critics Association press tour. Erwich also revealed that the award show will be produced by first-timer Will Packer. He did Girls Trip, Ride Along, and Think Like a Man. And show veteran Glenn Weiss returns for his 7th time to direct. Now, there's been a lot of buzz lately. You know, there's been names thrown around. I saw something about Pete Davidson potentially hosting. I've been seeing, you know, lots of requests. And even Maximum Fun's own Justin Hoops McElroy said that I should host the Oscars. Now, obviously,
oh my God, amazing.
There's you, one.
I was like, oh, someone wanted Hoops to host? No, Iffy planted that so that he could say someone said he wanted Iffy to host. Beautiful work.
Well, noted HBO Max podcaster,
yeah,
if you want.
Yeah, yeah. We got to get the buzz out there, because, you know,
you're right. Iffy, how it's meant to be said is, you know, a lot of people are talking about how they want Iffy to host.
A lot of people are talking about it.
A lot of grown men have come up to me crying.
Yeah, say, sir.
And everyone's still talking about that Moonlight, you know, situation happening at the end. And under my watch, that wouldn't happen with just one movie. It's going to happen with every movie. That's my dream. Every movie, you say the wrong one first and then the right one.
You're going to Steve Harvey it.
Yeah, yeah. Everyone, you have to say one wrong film and then the right one. But let's get to the question. Is this important? Do you care?
That's right. There is a question. I think that fine. They have to mix it up all the time. The most interesting name I've heard is Tom Holland.
Ooh.
And obviously, if you haven't seen him lip sync to Rihanna Umbrella, please go watch it 12 times in a row. And you will probably also want Tom Holland to host the Oscars. They're always trying to figure out how to bring in a younger audience. Spider-Man Far From Home was enormous box office in a very challenging time. He has song and dance skills. He's young and charming. There's interesting possibility there. And for me, I loved no host Oscars. I will. I loved it. I loved the like flow of it, but I absolutely can see where your average viewer wants that. It wouldn't surprise me if they actually figured out a way to have like staggered hosts or like people taking different sections or something. But I bet like, you know, there's the people they're talking to. I could easily, I'm sure they asked The Rock. I'm sure, like, to me, I'm like, ask Melissa McCarthy. Look, think she'd do a tremendous job.
As friend of the show, William Bibbs Bibiani always says on Twitter when this question comes up, get the Muppets. Get the goddamn Muppets.
Right. They're already an ABC property, aren't they?
Yes. Disney owns them. It's and right like, in there. They know how to host, you know, seemingly disastrous variety shows that are going off the rails.
I would absolutely watch the Muppets. If we are, in fact, also considering If You Want Away a Muppet, which I mean,
but, you know, I think everyone's making good points. I think the kids are talking about Iffy, too. I can't, every time I log into TikTok, they keep bringing up Iffy, why do you weigh this? Iffy, why do you weigh that? It's very weird. The buzz is out of
control.
You know who
said that to me?
Ooh.
A bunch of Muppets. A bunch of Muppets were talking about how they wanted Iffy to
hashtag help. Iffy hosts the Oscars is all over the place.
Who are the Oscars asking every year? It's like, they remember like how out of touch they are. And then like, who are they asking like for a reference of like, oh yeah, we should get a host again. Like Tom Holland like such a, hey, was that the last thing that kids liked? Let's get Spider-Man in there.
Girl, Tom Holland's still better than Pete Davidson, and they're both very high on the
list.
And
I think I think Tom Holland is an okay choice. I think Pete Davidson is a horrible choice. I think it should be somebody who is in the Tom Holland world, or like Hugh Jackman, or
Zendaya.
Does she have a lot of energy? Like, whenever I think of Zendaya, I just always think of like Euphoria billboards.
You want an Anne Hathaway. You do not want a James Franco.
Exactly. Yeah. You want somebody who's going to get up there and like put on a show.
Tom Holland's a tryhard.
Yes.
I appreciate that. Well, we might have to leave it to the actual show producers, sadly, for now. All right. So our final Itadic news item is like every day across the world, people leave this mortal coil. There's no nice way to say that. We lost two incredible forces in the film industry on the same day. Peter Bogdanovich at 82, Sidney Poitier at 94. Thankfully, they had long, beloved lives, which is the best thing you can say about loss. The idea of Sidney Poitier and discussing his impact is like nothing we could condense into a statement. So it's more of a nod to all he's done. He was a tremendous performer. And then if you have had any sense of film history, or if you haven't, Sidney Poitier is an incredible case study, because he was in such a unique scenario of being the first Black sort of, not just leading man, but heartthrob in ways. And then there were
movie star,
true. And like so much on his shoulders in terms of representation, and that he was criticized for both in the Black community, in the white community, and like the dedication he had as an activist, like everything that he did with a tremendous amount of class. And saying that always seems belittling, because he would have had all that on his shoulders even if he wasn't such a just elegant, wonderful human. And yeah, a truly impressive work. I have such a soft spot for A Patch of Blue, which is a film where he has many films you probably know better. A Patch of Blue is a love story of, well, sort of a love story of him and this white blind woman. And I just thought he was such an effortless actor who managed to carry that just sensibility into everything else. And I cannot imagine the burden that he was under. And what a gift that we lived at the same time as Sidney Poitier. Fellas, thoughts on Sidney Poitier?
Well, you know, he had the burden of being like the one black actor who for a very long time was the only person that the studios treated as like a bankable movie star, which indeed he was. And so, you know, we talk about the burden of representation, you know, when there aren't a lot of films about black people, about women, about, you know, the queer community or whatever, and one comes out, then suddenly everybody wants to tie all their stuff into that movie. And if it doesn't represent them, then they feel excluded by it. And, you know, he had to bear that burden himself as just the actor, the star who was, you know, able to like have his name above the title and be a leading man in a country that was still torn apart by Jim Crow. You know, I'm sure it, like, you know, you have so many of the great entertainers of that era who like would play at Vegas, but they had to come in through the kitchen. You know, I'm sure for Poitier, there were all those kind of landmines that he had to deal with as a guy who was a working movie star. But, you know, he was incredibly talented. And while we think of so much of his on-screen work as these very serious, very dignified characters, as a director, he could not make enough comedies. Like, you know, he made the ones that he was in, but then also like he was the first black director to break 100 million at the box office with the very ridiculous Stir Crazy starring, you know, Gene Wilder and Richard Pryor. So, you know, I love that he contained multitudes, you know. But yeah, he was the guy who literally there was nobody before him doing what he got to do and the path that he forged for himself. And everybody after him has had to say, you know, thank you, Sidney. I'm here because of you.
Yeah, I pretty much was going to say, thank you, Sidney. I'm here because of you, as a black actor myself. But, you know, yeah, it's, I remember I was, I think it was the Sony lot I was lost on for some audition for whatever the room, whatever. It was the Duplass anthology.
Oh, that HBO show.
Yeah. He didn't cast me in it, so, you know, no good things will be said. But there was a moment where it was like the Sidney Poitier section, like they dedicated a portion of this lot to him. And it was so dumb because in the great rigmarole of like auditions and stuff, it kind of sat on me where I was like, damn, yeah, he has a building. Because, you know, you go into all these lots and you'll see these like names of great white actors, producers and directors who you've never heard of. And, you know, they're usually white. They're usually, you know, because, you know, watch a movie while they're still figuring stuff out. But to see that and to see the power, like it was like the first time that me as an actor, I was like, oh yeah, no, I got to pay my respects. And then I kind of like stood there a little longer, mostly because I was lost, but secondarily to like kind of bask in it. So it really is like, it's scary, like being the first to do something like it, and especially in the time that he did it. Oh boy, you know that. You know, that's all I can really say about that. So it really is like a honest to God, jokes aside, thank you to him. And we can only hope to make him proud with our own legacies.
That's what's up, yo.
All of us in here, all of us equally make him proud.
I mean, Sidney Poitier to me always like represented like possibility. Like, oh, it's possible. All right. He's the guy. He's the first guy to do the thing. And that's kind of like the thing that I'm becoming more and more attracted to and attached to. And like, I didn't really get into Sidney Poitier until like way later in life. Like when I was a kid, like, I mean, I just wasn't ready for In the Heat of the Night. I wasn't ready for what's the one with the nuns?
Lilies of the Field.
Yes, yeah. Like there was just so many movies where I was like, or respect to you, dude, and I know who you are, but I'm still like not there yet. And then when I finally did get to like A Raisin in the Sun, And like, that's one of my favorite plays ever. And like, to see what he does, like, he's always going to be that character. Like that's the blueprint. Boom. You know, for whatever like production they do from here on out, like, he was the first one. And in my opinion, the best one as well. Yeah, like somebody said earlier, we're lucky to be alive when he was with us.
And to be clear, there were black leading men before him. You know, there was Paul Robeson. There was a whole, you know, kind of off Hollywood, like, you know, black cinema, which there have been really great, like, Blu-ray collections of, if you want to go back and get caught up with those films from the 1930s. But as far as like working in the studio system, a movie star, he was the guy who really broke that door open.
Yes, indeedy. So
he broke the door open for Iffy to host the Oscars.
Thank you. There we go. We can take a break. And when we come back, we'll be talking Encanto.
You're in a theater. The lights go down. You're about to get swept up by the characters and all their little details and interpersonal dramas. You look at them and think, that person is so obviously in love with their best friend. Wait, am I in love with my best friend? That character's mom is so overbearing. Why doesn't she just stand up to her? Oh God, do I need to stand up to my own mother? If you've ever recognized yourself in a movie, then join me, Jordan Cruciola, for the podcast Feeling Seen. We've talked to author Susan Orlean on realizing her own marriage was falling apart after watching Adaptation, an adaptation of her own work, and comedian Hari Kondabolu on why Harold and Kumar was a depressingly important movie for Southeast Asians. So join me every Thursday for the Feeling Seen podcast here on Maximum Fun.
Welcome back to Maximum Film. I'm Neil Sivuadiwe. In the studio with me are...
Drea Clark,
Ricky Carmona,
Alonzo Duralde.
And today we're going to get into Disney's Encanto, which you can stream right now on Disney Plus. So if you haven't, go ahead and pause and watch it, because I want to talk about everything. So go ahead, pause and watch it. I'm calling it now because it's on streaming. You can pause it now, go watch it and come back.
Yeah, you can borrow your rich friend's Disney Plus first, then watch it, then come back. Yep.
Yeah. Just let us know. Drea said she's willing to let anyone use her Disney Plus account. Just you know, just ask nicely.
I think it's adorable. You think I'm the rich friend? Shout out to my friend Carolina, who lets me use her Disney Plus.
Well, since you're all charged up on that, you know, acquired Disney Plus, why don't you kick things off by telling people what they need to know about the movie?
I will. Let's kick it up. So, Encanto, as I say it, so we are following young Mirabel and the Madrigal family. They live in literally a magical house. The house is alive in a way that's not creepy, which is the very first thing this film accomplishes. Mirabel is the only member of her family, we quickly find out, who was not bestowed a magical gift. Their magical gifts are powered by a candle. All of this sounds ridiculous, and yet it all makes sense when you see it. And the worst thing, if you are a magical family who use your power to sustain and support the village around you, is if that magic is threatened, which indeed is exactly what happens. Mirabel wants to get to the bottom of it, and her family is kind of worried she's going to destroy all they have in the process. So it's that and a lot of songs and a lot of funny John Leguizamo, actually not enough, just a small amount of funny John Leguizamo, and Encanto! There.
Gotta say, amazing. You know, mostly hitting it off by, like, you know, ending with the title.
I do it spelling bee style. You start and end with the word. Yeah.
Nice. All right, well, I want to kick this first question off by super producer Laura, and I want to direct it directly to none other then Ricky Carmona, and yes. then we, you know, well, we can all answer it. But what were some of the highlights for you in centering the story in Colombia? Any particular details that you appreciated?
We've come so far since Romancing the Stone, as far as movies set in Colombia. Oh my goodness. Just, yes, I don't like musicals. Valid. And this is like a first timer, you know, for me, in the sense of like, I was immediately all in as soon as the first song started playing, because like that first bass beat that you hear, that like, that's Colombia right there. I was like, all right, okay, I'm in. There it is. That's my sound. And then the accordion starts right after that. And I don't, if the world does not know Colombia, we shred on the accordion, yo. We can make that bitch cry. Like, that is our instrument. So I just put so much like faith and trust in the movie from that first like opening note. And I was definitely coming in, you know, I wasn't coming in like super guarded, but they're just, I mean, I guess I am a little like, you know, protective of like, all right, you're gonna tell my story here. Let's see what you think my story is. And then it starts, the story is like this magical realism, you know, which like in the first like 5 minutes, that's like where my brain went like, oh man. I tried reading a Gabriel Garcia Marquez book and I was like, I'm too young for this.
I'm just somebody I know said this is the closest we may ever get to a movie of 100 years of solitude.
I'm so glad you brought that up, because the magical realism was the thing I responded to first. I mean, I would have responded to the accordions if I had known. Now that I do, when I rewatch it, that will definitely be a highlight. But the magical realism, I took one of my favorite classes I ever took in college was about Latin American literature, and magical realism is such a specific part of that. Obviously, Gabriel Garcia Marquez. But I got so much Isabel Allende. I tried. Yes, she's who's a Chilean author, wrote The House of the Spirits. House of the Spirits in Encanto, there's so much weird parallel, like in terms of your deep bed of family stories, and like it's a multi-generational, and the history is part of it. And then also like there's all these siblings and everyone has different gifts, and some of them are dark and they're all metaphorical in some way. And I thought that for ostensibly a family movie, this animated musical, there was so much sophisticated, subtle storytelling happening that was hearkening back to this really rich literature, you know, like background. I was so impressed by that. And obviously, like, Disney movies through time have had magic, like, you know, the whole Sorcerer's Apprentice. It's been cooked into plenty of them. This one, though, felt very specific to this time and place, like Ricky was saying.
And the familial aspect of it as well.
Yeah.
Like, my favorite, like, animated movie is The Incredibles. And that's like a family of five, you know, which to us, you know, or to like, that's the typical American nuclear size family. You know, the Madrigal family, there's like 12 of them, you know, like when she's she's singing and she's introducing the song and she's like on her fourth cousin or whatever. I'm like, yep.
That opening number is me and Dave White in Spain. When we go to Spain and he's got to meet all of my cousins and my aunts and my uncles and my dad's side and my mom's side, it's like it's all but flashcards.
And like, it took me a while to like figure out she doesn't have to go defeat the thing. She doesn't have to go.
Yeah,
like,
there's no villain in this movie.
Yes.
Yeah, totally. Totally.
Like, there's no quest in this movie.
Yeah.
And were you waiting for that?
I mean, an emotional one, maybe.
I thought I love that the emotional quest was her having to go deeper into the house to go like find Bruno. Like everything was about like the family and the house, like the thing that they have to stop is the foundation is crumbling, you know, where they live, the family is literally like falling apart.
Yeah, this is like the most, I'd say, emotionally complicated Disney movie probably since Inside Out, just in terms of not being about the traditional sort of like, you know, quest narrative and reluctant, you know, hero and all that stuff, but really being about how families work and how, even with the best of intentions, you know, like we can cause damage to each other, and how there is a way through that, and there is a way to understand each other and to mend, you know, those things that are broken. And that's a lot to take on for a movie that is, you know, aimed at a family audience, but they pull it off really well.
Yeah. Yeah. It's that perfect recipe of like something for everyone. Right. And I do think it tackles like some topics that you can like, you know, tackle at every age. Like, you know, you have like the level of like, you know, not quite feeling like you fit in with your family and still finding a way to feel like a part of it, to like the upper level thing, to like going against this, like, generational hierarchy that might not work all the time, you know, especially, you know, people of color. We are very, you know, dependent on this like matriarchal, patriarchal, you know, families that is like, oh, well, it's because grandpa says so. It's because grandma says so. And no one challenges it, even if it doesn't make sense. And that was one moment that really kind of like shook me to my core of being like, no, sometimes you might have to point something out to grandma that like you've been doing me kind of dirty, and you've let yourself get away with it, and I have to stand up for myself to show you how you've been treating me. And that I think was wild and good, because I think that's a lesson that till this day a lot of families are learning and need to learn.
Well, it's built into the fiber of each character that they have this different struggle, and it's tied into their gifts in ways that I found so fascinating. So you have like this wonderful Tia, who her whole thing is that the weather reflects her emotions. And so, of course, you get all these great visuals with that. Like, oh, like there's a rain cloud that even follows her inside. Or she's happy, it's so sunny. But then the movie actually spends the time investigating the pressure of that. And like every time that this woman, that actually is directly from Inside Out, right? Like the learning that the sorrow or the rain is like an okay part of it. So this woman, her whole life is given this gift, but then also you see numerous times member of her family when she's distraught and therefore the weather is affected, they're like, cheer up right now. And that,
yeah, her emotional labor is literal.
There's so much, and that's just one character that, all of the characters, I think you could find similar sort of deeper archetypes of how their gifts work against them. The song that honestly hit me the most was, and
the
it's
strong
one of my,
sister.
Yes, the strong sister, one of
Louisa,
my favorite characters.
My queen.
Louisa, bodybuilding, like buff, powerhouse, thick. brick house of a woman. And I love that. I don't know any time I've ever seen a character like that, that wasn't like, she most reminded me of, oh, is it in, oh my God, why can't I think of it, with the gingerbread, Shrek, Jesus. Shrek had like the ugly stepsisters. And I feel like one of the ugly stepsisters had like a similar physique. For laughs, Louisa is this powerful entity. She's the strongest one in the family, easily could have been the boy role. And she's like, nope, I'm the girl and I pick everything up or whatever. But her whole song was about the pressure that came with that. And that's when I was like, oh, this movie is not just giving me these, like, it's magical realism. These are the gifts. This one makes flowers. It was actually going to spend the time digging into all of the layers of those things and how they can be difficult.
Her literal burden as somebody who can like carry, you know,
yes.
Yeah. Like the emotional burden of that. Like, you're right. I mean, it really kind of, it does thread that needle. The specificity of Colombia, it's kind of interesting because like we're so used to like a lot of the Disney storybook movies are sort of set in some sort of like European Grimm's fairy tale, unspecified, you know, kingdom or whatever. But like in this one, when the grandmother talks about how like, oh, 50 years ago, we were driven out of our village, you know, and they're being like chased by horses and stuff. And I'm thinking like, 50 years ago, it would have been like Jeeps, and maybe it was like an American-backed junta. Like, I started thinking about that. It's like, no, this is magical realism. It's fine. Doesn't matter.
But also, this could be in the past. We don't know what year this took place.
That also true. But then, but what I wanted to ask Ricky about with the specifics of Colombia is the visual representation of the characters, because they are not all ethnically of a piece. Like, you see a lot of different, you know, you have the African Caribbean versus that's just not a thing we see in animated films a lot.
This was probably my favorite like animated movie to watch after Soul, where I was like, there it is right there. Like, they, Soul and Encanto, they get our hair so right. Like, I almost get like emotional like when I see it the first time, because it's like it's like fucking seeing Terminator 2 for the first time, and you've just never seen the T-1000 before, but now like I'm the T-1000, and yes, thank you. I'm there, thank you. That's like,
It's Christian Bale pointing to the TV in Velvet Goldmine and saying, "That's me. Yeah. That's me."
Yes, it's the Leo meme in Once Upon a Time. When, oh hey, I wanted to say also too, Drea, you talked about the song with Pressure. Like I took that song as like being a Latino and like the first generation pressure that Latinos have from their parents. And like the expectation, like the unhealthy expectation that I've put in myself and have grown up with, like I that's just so great to like, you watch the movie and that's what you heard in the song. Like, I watched the movie and I was like, oh no, yeah, it's the same right. struggle, but it's like a different kind of struggle, you know? Like, I thought the movie was so smart in like having, you know, you all call them layers like that. Like, I'm going to get my thing from it. Somebody's getting their thing from it. It's pretty fantastic. And shout out to Carlos Vives. They had some Carlos Vives up in this piece. Lin-Manuel Miranda. Shout out to Lin-Manuel Miranda. He gets all the shout outs. Yes. Yes to all that. But Carlos Vives is a huge Colombian star. At one of the few times that I did leave the house last year, I went and saw him perform at the Hollywood Bowl. He is from the same town that my city that my mom is from in Colombia. So like, I've been going to Colombia since the 80s, and to see like his rise from, I would only hear his music when I was in Colombia, and now I'm seeing that shit on Disney Plus. Like, it's a pretty great, amazing thing. So shout out to his banger, and my favorite banger was Dos Orguitas.
I think
that's a great
song.
That's
their Oscar contender. That's the one they submitted for this one.
That was
good. I do, my last design thing that I want to give a nod to is just Mirabelle herself. Disney has been around for a million years. Alonso might have to fact check me on that one, but we have seen so many princesses typically, but the female leads are things that if you saw just the silhouette, they're all the same. It's a very slender, yet buxom. They have a pert nose, they have flowing hair. And Mirabelle has like this beautiful bob with these curls. She has glasses. There's no part of me that is like, okay, girls don't actually look like that in real life. She is darling and would make a wonderful doll, but also I didn't have that disconnect. And I love that in their building out, if they'd put that much effort into the building out of this world and then given me a girl
yet
with
another,
the same feel as everyone from Jasmine to Ariel to Cinderella, I would have been like, okay, Disney. So I want to, like, my high five is going to designers and team that gave me beautiful Mirabelle.
It only took them 60 feature animated films to do it. I really love, I love that about that character. But what I also love is, I think it, there's something about her that, and what she goes through that taps into a feeling that people so often have, where she's the one in the family that hasn't been endowed with this, you know, these special gifts. And I think very often it's very easy, especially if you come from a large family, to have those moments where you feel like you're the one that isn't carrying their weight and isn't like as special or as awesome as the other ones are, you know, like I'm the boy in my family who didn't become a doctor, you know? And I've related to her. I felt what she was going through. And I think that's a really strong message because she is also the one who saves the day. She is the one who gets to be there for the family and give the family what it needs.
I spend a lot, my family dynamic is me trying to make my brother feel like he's the one that didn't get the gifts. So I'm coming at it from a little different of an angle. But yeah, I get it. I get what you're saying.
I feel like it's kind of open at the end. I don't think she gets a gift. Do you guys think that she got a gift? Do you think that her, or do you think that she just opens the door and the house is back and... things
or that it was like, it's sort of implied that it's her magical touch that brings the magic back to this house. But we don't see that come in play. We don't see like, oh, Mirabelle's now a dispenser of magic.
Right.
It was
right.
More like we're meant to be comfortable and sated with the idea of, no, her gift was honesty and, you know, emotional, like, justice,
clarity,
yeah, and bringing them all, like reconciling some truths that go far back and bringing them all together.
And I love the fact also that it takes the community to bring the house back, that like this family has been sort of like vaulted, and you know, they've kind of been there for everybody else, but it's sort of like, you know, you're special, you're untouchable, you're above us all, but now we're going to be there for you. And so this house that you now enjoy is a product of all of us coming together to do this.
Yeah. Vote.
Yeah. Vote. We'll let Ricky do the honors as the esteemed guest.
Oh, well, thank you. Thank you for having me and saying all those nice things. You're wonderful. I definitely wish that I could have screened this in the theater with my Colombian nieces and newborn nephew. And I can't wait to the day that I stream this movie with my Colombian nieces and newborn nephew. I thought we would get an animated episode of Narcos before we got what this is, with this gift that was given to us. So I was a big fan. I watched it twice.
Nice.
Yeah.
I will probably watch it again because Dave didn't watch it yet, but I want him to now. I'm for sure a screen it. This is going on my list of movies that when it, you know, the world returns to something resembling normalcy, that I hope get another go round in theaters. You know, Barb and Star still top of the list, but this one's right up there. Cause yeah, it would be a delight to see just those colors and to hear that music through like a big booming sound system and to enjoy it with an audience. Yeah. I thought this was really delightful.
I loved this movie. I cried exactly when they wanted me to cry. And I also cried a couple other times. This is a screen it. I think it's a really special film. I think they really did well by what they were trying to do.
Yeah, no, I'm a big screen it. You know, especially like when it's safe, when you get the chance. And if they do, they really should do a whole fest of like things that we missed during the pandemic where we screened it, because on like it was so crisp and beautiful on my TV. And I can only imagine how it would look on a screen slightly bigger. So
did you watch it with Naomi?
I did not. That's why I know that when everyone's like, I'm going to rewatch it, I'm like, well, I'm going to rewatch it multiple times. I'm probably going to know all the lyrics.
Get ready.
Yeah, all the lyrics from the whole soundtrack, the Billboard, number one Billboard soundtrack. That's going to be your boy. So, yeah. on that note, you know, I'm going to say, let's keep it rocking and rolling, and we'll be right back after we hear from another show from Maximum Fun.
I'm Lisa Hannawalt.
And I'm
I'm Emily Heller. 9 years ago, we started a podcast to try and learn something new every episode.
Things have gone a little off the rails since then. Tune in to hear about
low-stakes neighborhood drama,
gardening,
the sordid, nasty underbelly of the horse girl lifestyle,
hot sauce,
addiction to TV and sweaty takes on celebrity culture,
and the weirdest, grossest stuff you can find on Wikipedia.org.
We'll read all of it, no matter how gross. There's something for everyone on our podcast, Baby Geniuses.
Hosted by us, two horny adult idiots.
Hang out with us as we try and fail to retain any knowledge at all.
Every other week on Maximum Fun. Baby Geniuses, tell us something we don't know.
All right, welcome back to Maximum Film. I'm your host, Ify Wadiway, and I'm in the booth with
Alonzo Duralde,
Ricky Carmona,
Drea Clark.
Okay, I think we're all in agreement that Disney did a good job with its portrayal of the Madrigal family, but the same can't be said about other characters in the studio's catalog. In fact, many of their older films come with content warning, as in warning, this film you're about to see may be wildly inappropriate for children because racism or sexism, homophobia, you get the idea. So for this segment, we thought we'd talk about the checkered past. So here's the fun question. If we had to rank the top five Disney films based on their offensiveness, which ones would be on the list?
Like the lower five, the bottom five.
Yeah. I guess we would
have top five, lowest five.
Yeah. Top five, lowest five.
There's an array here. I know in the past, like we've talked about Song of the South, like when they decided not to put that initially on Disney Plus, and then I can't remember if it's still not on there, and then there's others that they have added with sort of...
You can get it on Fox News.
Content warning, yes. Song of the South, but that's the 2022 version. For the 1946, yeah, it's not. But, and then for me, like, there's a broader idea of... I find there's a million sort of red flags of how women are portrayed throughout Disney films. I already mentioned sort of physically, but there's also... There are numerous instances of... non-consensual kissing, which bothers me so much as a grown adult, of like, why are so many women being kissed in their sleep?
See, that's why we need LeBron James to sit them down and explain consent to them, you know, but people are afraid of that conversation.
Oh my God. But I do think that there are some, you know, there's like, those are the more nuanced conversations to have of like, cool, let me explain why him bestowing a kiss upon an unconscious woman is not a great thing. But then you do have the more just like on the nose. Like one of the things on this great list is from Dumbo. I love Dumbo. We watched the remake of Dumbo. Like Dumbo it pulls on the old heartstrings. And then it straight up has some racist ass crows. Like to build in an entire chorus of racist crows that have this sort of minstrel element.
We always on Linoleum Knife, we talk periodically about how, like, if you go back and watch movies from the 30s or 40s and into the 50s, even, it's like you just have to sort of be ready for that moment where, oh no.
Oh, Fred Astaire's in blackface.
We're doing that.
Yeah. I know. I think the saddest thing is how much those crows do entertain me. I'm like, oh, they got some black crows because you get it because the crow, but then you really, because it would have been wild if it went with, because there's a lot of like those like line walking type things, but then you learn that the character's name is indeed Jim Crow. And then I was like, okay, all right. Well, come on. Y'all weren't happy just letting it just be a little, just a little racist personification. Y'all had to go the whole.
Leaned in.
Yeah.
How do you think the pitch went? Like they're putting together Dumbo. Everybody's bringing their A game.
I got it.
Yeah. What? Alonzo, Ricky, did you guys have something for these birds we talked about? Any thoughts? Like, we'd really like to make it feel regionally specific.
To go back to Song of the South real quick, though, I am of an age where that movie used to be in the rotation when Disney movies were theatrically reissued. Like when I was a kid, every like 6 months or so, they would bring back one of the old Disney movies. It would be Lady and the Tramp. It would be Cinderella. It would be Sleeping Beauty, you know, whatever. But Song of the South, they would just throw that one in there, and they kept doing it until like the early 80s, you know, and until finally it was like, maybe not, you know.
And you were like, quit trying to make Song of the South happen.
I went to see it because it was a Disney movie, you know, and that was your brand of, you know, whatever. And that was one of the things that later in life I came to realize, oh my God, you know, but it's like, oh, zippity doodah, who doesn't love that song, you know? But this may be apocryphal, but I was told a story by somebody that basically when they were thinking about putting Song of the South out on Laserdisc, but what they were going to do was there was going to be an unskippable prologue, and it was going to be like Whoopi Goldberg and, you know, Bill Cosby, because it was at the time, you know, and all these sort of like black, you know, filmmakers and historians of talking about the film, putting it in context, explaining, you know, the function of this and that, and, you know, this works and this doesn't, and all of that stuff. And they like put it to a panel of like activists and academics, and they showed him the whole intro part, and then they showed him the movie, and they were like, no. No, you can't release this. No. And so I think it's just never, ever coming out of the Disney vault, because it's just,
Yeah, there's no retrofitting that one.
Yeah.
What about, so in Peter Pan, we fly off. We're literally in a different world. We're in Never Never Land. Mm. But don't worry about it, guys, because there's still a tribe of natives in Never Never Land, led by a girl named Tiger Lily, and they keep referring to them as Redskins. And then the Lost Boys, don't they dress up like them? Like they do, like,
I think they do,
like a whole thing. And it's like, again, you're literally in there, you're in the sky, you're like, what is it, two stars over and straight on through morning? Why the shit is there this like offensive?
And they keep bringing back Princess Tiger Lily. Like when they did Peter Pan as a live musical at NBC, she was in that terrible Pan movie. I think Rooney Mara played her. It's like, not you mean already?
Everyone's favorite indigenous actress, Rooney Mara?
Exactly. Yes. Really bringing the credibility to that one. Yeah. So it's like, I mean, yes, Disney gets it all wrong, but sadly, so does like every fucking production of Peter Pan.
Yeah. Okay, so, you know, just a reminder of the ranking. I think Song of the South is the clear number one. I don't think we're going to top that. Number two, I think I am going to throw up the Dumbo, just, you know, Jim Crow being one of the crows. Yeah, number three, why not make it Peter Pan? Why not just go in order of this trash fire of the way they did it back then? What's funny to me is that the Song of the South came out after Dumbo, so that means that they had to have made the Jim Crow crows and was like, yeah, we didn't do enough.
That's the worst. Man. People probably love those stupid crows because people are trash. That is historically real.
Yeah, Amos and Andy was a radio hit when all this was going on, and they were played by white people.
Any final Disney?
I'm gonna have to throw Fantasia on there, because I forgot about Sunflower the Centaurette and the hairstyle that she had, and oh boy, Disney, what?
Words are his tool, people. What, Disney? Whoa. No, I'm with you. Also, you had me obviously at Centaurette, but the idea that you could make a lady centaur is what I'm getting out of that, and make it still culturally insensitive. Like, that's a heavy lift. Good for them. Just kidding. Take out the good for them. I'm not cheering on Disney's bad choices. I'm not.
I do want an insensitive animated movie, though, Sausage Party was a hot mess. Like, they didn't like get that right at all. But I hate also that, I mean, there needs to be this this audience, or like I want them to start marketing like this, some kind of adult animation for, so so jokes like this can happen in that movie. So it's no longer we're just seeing what's wrong in the animation. Like, let's now bring it into the conversation, into the movie. You know, like,
yeah, the majority of adult animated films, or that sounded pervier than I meant, but animated films with adult audiences in mind.
Yeah, that's called hentai.
Yeah, yeah. No, I know. Please don't Google that if you don't know what it is. You won't be happy about what it does to your algorithm.
Anomalisa was that one? I mean, that was an Anomalisa, animation.
Well, it's stop motion.
Sure,
but
yeah.
Stop motion, right?
You have a lot of those. They tend to have either a fantasy element or they're broader. Yeah, it would be, in our country at least, like the animation that's being made for audiences, there's still a whole world of potential for what they could do with it. So, yes, let's do that. And let's leave the centaurs in the vault when we do it. Oh, okay. I feel good about this. I feel like we've righted these wrongs. Yeah. And I would like to ask Laura Swisher, who, by the way, people, you'll recognize her name. Laura Swisher was our esteemed executive producer. She is filling in until our new, brand new producer begins. Laura had a great question for me, although the phrasing made me laugh. As the broad, Drea, what lady portrayals get you most hysterical? Which is exactly, which is right in there. All, and I'm just going to say, hands down, Snow White is concerning in so many ways. I don't know what she's doing with those young men. She's being kissed in her sleep. There's just problems all over the place that nobody brings up. I don't
Are the dwarves, are they young? I mean, they've all got like white
old
beards.
Men. You're right. I don't know how
that doesn't make it better.
I guess I was picturing Sneezy when I said that.
Yeah.
It's weird. They make her take care of them. They make her cook and clean, and then she sleeps and some dude kisses her. I don't feel comfortable with it. I don't like it. And find me separately and I'll talk to you a good deal about it.
All right. Well, I will have something else that I want you to talk to us a great deal about, because now it's time for staff picks. It can be any movie at all. Drea, why don't you start?
Well, I want to recommend this film called Snow White. I love it so much. JK. There's a film that I believe you can rent. I think, and I do know it's on Hulu, a German film called I'm Your Man that I adored. It stars Dan Stevens, who performs the entire film in German and does such a good job of it. You will Google more than once, did Dan Stevens already speak German? And I know I did, because it kept coming up as a prompt. I typed it that many times. But it is like an intellectual romantic comedy. How's that? It has some thought-provoking themes to it, but also some lighthearted love stuff and then some heavy-hearted love stuff. And I really liked it. I love the director. I think this is her second feature. She also directed a ton. I'm looking it up because I can't believe I didn't remember to look it up first. She's directed a ton of a TV show. Her name is Maria Schrader. And if you give me 2 seconds, I will tell you what dumb TV show I can't think of right now that everybody wants. Unorthodox. Duh. Which so you might know her work from there. Maria Schrader. Very talented. But I found I'm Your Man so charming, so watchable. It's absolutely going to be remade as an American film, and it will absolutely disappoint. So please see the original. You'll enjoy it. You won't even notice the subtitles in a minute. I'm Your Man. Done.
I second that vote, and I would also recommend that if you're going to watch I'm Your Man, you could make a double feature. Go over to Pluto TV and watch Susan Seidelman's Making Mr. Right, starring Anne Magnuson and John Malkovich. I think that would be a great back-to-back thing.
I'll revisit that.
But my staff pick is a 60s spy movie that I absolutely love, and I think that people will get a kick out of. It's called Danger Diabolic. It is based on a popular Italian comic strip, and basically, producer Dino De Laurentiis, after doing Barbarella, thought, well, what are some other like sort of sexy European comic strips I can turn into a movie and maybe reuse some of the sets from Barbarella? And he came up with Danger Diabolic, which is directed by Mario Bava. Diabolic is like, you know, the world's greatest cat burglar or something. I forget. The plot is barely the point. It's just like a visual feast of like crazy, you know, like editing and car chases and cliff climbing. And if you've ever seen the Beastie Boys body moving video, the entire video is an homage to Danger Diabolic. I think using actual footage from that movie. So if that is your jam, you'll have a great time with this. And it's on Canopy.
Yes, the Alonzo Network. Ricky,
Mikey, do you have anything?
I do. Yes. You know, I recently watched The Tragedy of Macbeth. Which I thought was very good, but that's not my staff pick. Watching that movie led me to my staff pick. I rewatched Malcolm X, which is now streaming on HBO. And we were just talking about Sidney Poitier at the beginning of the show, and I feel very confident saying Denzel is. And you know, that's when that sad day comes that Denzel leaves us, I feel like he will be in the very same conversation as Sidney Poitier. And Malcolm X is the example, there's the, you know, exhibit A through Z right here. Here it all is.
A through X.
Oh, well, it was right
I'm glad
there.
Somebody said it.
It was right there. Yep.
And that it wasn't me.
It's really like on other level what Denzel does in that movie, performance wise, movie wise, like it spikes. I think it's the best thing he's going to do, but I'm hoping that he's got one more left in him. But I do think that's Spike working like at the height of his powers. It's a great story behind that, just finding out like how much trouble Spike had to go through to get that movie made. And it was really great to watch at the beginning of the year. I read an article, somebody watches that movie once a year. So I was like, all right, let me revisit Malcolm X. And it was just great to watch at the beginning of the year. Like everybody's coming up with their resolutions and this is what I'm going to do this year. And it was very much just kind of like a spiritual cleanse for me. Like, all right, cool. Now we can, it just made me like key up. Like, all right, let's go. We're a little bit more focused here. So Malcolm X streaming on that HBO, holler at that. It'll make you feel good about yourself.
Solid. Iffy, I bet you got a good choice.
I do.
A choice that I will find questionable. I'm excited to see
you
which
know,
it
with
is.
This. With this star-studded cast, it was very easy to bounce off of one of the actors or actresses to find my staff pick. Of course, I'm choosing none other than, my fave, John Leguizamo, who has a gajillion movies to pick from for a staff pick. So, you know, I went with 1997 Spawn, led by Michael Jai White, John Leguizamo as the Violator, with the great, great makeup and costumings, solid action, balls to the wall, full suit up motor Spawn motorcycle. You know, you want to see it if you haven't seen it yet. And it's on Netflix.
Whoa. I'm so glad Ricky finally was able to support your choice in the way that Alonzo and I rarely do.
I had a hunch if he was going to say Spawn, but part of me thought, oh God, is he going to say The Pest?
I thought he was going to say The Pest.
No, I know. I saw The Pest. I thought, but I was like, no, this is a good time to big up the Spawn.
Thank you for giving John Leguizamo love. I did not give him enough love during our Encanto discussion.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
He's never a misstep.
Truly.
He played Bruno. For anyone who watched it, He is Bruno. He is always Bruno. He's wonderful.
You'll be talking.
I love the he's always knocking on the wood. Hilarious. Fantastic. So
well, you know who else is hilarious? You, Ricky. Thank you for coming on the show. Yay, is there anything Ricky, you'd like to plug before we get out of here?
Hey, no, thank you. Shout out to everybody out there. You're all beautiful, and I love you, and thank you for having me.
Well, thanks for coming through, truly. And thanks for listening, you listener. Yeah, I'm talking to you now. And if you have a comment or suggestion about this week's show, tweet at us at @maximum_film. Our Facebook group can be found at www.facebook.com/groups/maximumfilm or send us an email at maximumfilm@maximumfun.org. Our interim producer is the wonderful Laura Swisher. Woo! Our senior producer is Kevin Ferguson. And this is a production of Maximum Fun.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned. Audience supported.